Welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning Utah news week in review from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, we'll do something of an election recap. Senator Mike Lee successfully fended off an independent challenge from Evan McMullen. Utah's all Republican congressional delegation sailed easily to victory in the 2022 midterm elections, but predictable or not, we will delve into some of those details. Also, later in the show, scientists say that the Great Salt Lake's ecological collapse has begun. So will a pause on water rights allocations by Utah's governor make any difference? Joining me for this conversation here in studio, we've got Salt Lake Tribune State Watch editor Jeff Parrott. And Jeff, thanks for being here. Good morning.
Thanks for having me, Your Honor.
Water and land use reporter Leah Larson joins us via the Zoom, and good morning to you, Leah.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And now our now recurring regular guest, news columnist Robert Gerke, is with us in the studio as well. And Robert, welcome to you.
Good to be back.
And a good Veterans Day to everyone who is listening as well. You can join this conversation if you would like to by calling us up. The number is 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to at KCPW, and we will try and get your questions and comments here on air. Election week. I think people are aware of the big highlights, you know, the Senator Mike Lee winning despite a pretty serious challenge. All of the congressional delegation had that easy victory, as I just mentioned. And redistricting, you know, had a role to play in some of that. But Jeff Parrott, State Watch editor, I want to ask you this question just to start with. Was anything, obviously Tuesday night was a long one for you, and thank you for the coverage that the Tribune did, but was anything about what happened on Tuesday night into Wednesday morning and, you know, until now surprising to you?
So one thing has stood out in, I think, the last couple of days that's been surprising, and maybe only surprising to me as the new politics editor at the Tribune. And that is, as of last night, the Utah Senate majority and minority leaders have been elected. Hmm. So the representatives that were just reelected or are in the process of being reelected 48 hours after ballots closed have gone ahead and elected themselves leadership, which I thought was a fast turnaround.
So surprising to you because of how quickly it happened,
yeah.
Basically.
And as ballots are still being tabulated, not that there's anything that's going to change, but.
Hmm. And before the election actually gets certified, which doesn't happen for a couple of weeks anyways, Robert Gerke, maybe I'll just, is this just because it's such a foregone conclusion at the legislature that leadership can be chosen so quickly?
Yeah, I don't think there were any really contested leadership races except for the assistant whip in the House. And so it's pretty much the same leadership team as before. It's kind of a rubber stamp type function. But there are still races that are potentially could turn. I remember covering this same issue arose a few years ago, and there was a race that was very close, and the question was, you know, does this person get to vote or not? And the answer basically at that time was, well, if it changes, you know, he cast sort of a provisional vote, I guess, is how it worked, and if it changed the outcome, then they could go back and rarely does it, and especially when it's sort of a pro forma kind of thing where it's a foregone conclusion that these, you know, that Brad Wilson was going to be speaker and Stuart Adams was going to be president, for example. So yeah, that's the way they approach those.
Assistant Majority Whip, you mentioned that this is Carrie Ann Lisenby, who is now in that position.
Yeah, Carrie Ann Lisenby is kind of been a up and comer, I think, in the House. One of the more conservative members, and has risen through the ranks fairly quickly. She still will probably chair the Judiciary Committee. No, maybe not, but I don't know how that's going to work out. But you know, she's held a pretty powerful position there as chair of Judiciary and sponsored some bills, been a leader on, you know, sort of abortion related issues and so forth, and the conversion therapy issue from a couple years back, so opposing that issue. So she's an up and comer and now is in a leadership position, and she certainly
helped take the lead this summer in the wake of post Roe v. Wade and what the legislature will be doing moving forward with the state trigger law or anything else.
Yeah, she and Kira Berkland have been pushing hard on that issue.
Didn't they send a letter? I mean, they sent a letter to Planned Parenthood, was it? No, or
they sent a letter to a couple members of Planned Parenthood and a doctor who a practitioner who performed abortions and kind of made a threatening, you know, statements. And You know, I'm trying to think if she is the most recent woman in House leadership since Speaker Lockhart passed. I think she may well be.
We kind of dove right into the weeds there with this, but Robert, I want to ask you the same question that I asked Jeff, which was there any outcome of Tuesday's election that sort of stood out to you as surprising, as something that you weren't expecting?
Yeah, as I wrote in my piece today, I think the margin in the Mike Lee, Evan McMullen race was a little bit surprising. It stands right now at about 13%. You know, the polling going into it was all over the place, but I think there was a sense that that it was going to be a little bit tighter than that. Further down ballot, I think it looks like Suzanne Harrison is going to beat Richard Snellgrove. There's still about 130,000 ballots, I think, left to be counted in that race, so it could tighten, but I think it looks like she's got a comfortable lead right now. So, I think it's more the margin than the outcome in that one, in my mind, too.
Can we talk a little bit about the Lee McMullen race? Just you have this column out. You talk about it being sort of a model for the future, and it's the most expensive race, as I think, in Utah in the history of the state. What is your column says that despite his not having beaten the incumbent McMullen, the McMullen run was something that was notable. Why?
Yeah, I mean, I talked about a few of the mistakes I think that the McMullen campaign made. This is sort of armchair quarterbacking, I think, Evan was quick out of the gate and got the people locked up in his camp who were opposed to Lee's actions leading up to January 6th. But I think ultimately he needed to give those who maybe were in undecided a better reason to vote for him. He needed to give them a sense of vision of how he would be different than Mike Lee. And I don't think he really accomplished that. And part of that was because there was so much noise and clutter with all the attack ads on both sides of the, going back and forth, the tens of millions of dollars that were spent. I think he needed to give them a better explanation of what he would do and, how he would be postpartisan and work with, work across the aisle for solutions. And I just don't think that was there. That said, I think...
extremely negative. I mean, the campaign was as negative a campaign as I have seen in this state.
Yeah, and it worked. Everybody in Utah says that everybody likes to think that negative ads don't work in Utah, but this is certainly evidence that they do. And Mike Lee's attack ads and those that were being run by Club for Growth and others were incredibly effective. I mean, they managed to paint McMullen as a Trojan horse Democratic candidate and a deadbeat and all of these things. And it was a nasty campaign. And I think evidence for that is that Mike Lee's victory speech the night of the campaign, he didn't thank his opponent. He didn't mention his opponent at all. And so I think there's probably still some bad blood there, too. But all of that said, it is the closest... As it stands right now, is the closest Senate race since 1976 when Frank Moss lost to Orrin Hatch. Evan McMullen got more votes than any Senate challenger in history. And I think both of those things kind of show that this is perhaps a model going forward for, this moderate base of Utahns, mainstream Utahns, to actually have a voice in politics. Because Mike Lee, this is his third time he's run, he's never had to even think about the mainstream Utah, the moderates, the unaffiliated or the Democrats or even moderate Republicans. He's had his base, and no matter who the Democrats throw against him or who they threw against Orrin Hatch or who they throw against Mitt Romney, there's just not enough of them to actually warrant a, response or concern. And the fact that there was $30 million that came in that wasn't being spent in other states, by the way, the fact that there's $30 million that came in all of these ads kind of shows that he had to work for it. He had to sweat a little, and he had to, maybe consider where other voters might be rather than just, kind of pander to his base.
It sounds a little bit, though, like you're saying that the Democrats going forward shouldn't run anybody and should do what they did this time around. Is that sort of what you think will do better than, there were a number of places where Democrats were not on the ballot across the state because the Democrats had said, this isn't what we're going to do. But usually those higher up races have a Democrat on the ballot.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of Senate races that were not contested. I think that Democrats certainly can run somebody. United Utah Party can certainly run somebody. Kind of positioned itself when it started to be this middle of the road moderate campaign. There, you do potentially run into a problem, and it was unique this time that Democrats didn't run somebody, but you know, where you could split that vote, you know, the moderate vote, the mainstream vote, whatever you want to call it. But it's, you know, so that's a decision I guess they have to make on a case by case basis. Had there been a Democrat in the race, it certainly wouldn't have been as close as it was. Mike Lee might have got fewer votes, but he would have won by a larger margin. So it does complicate the math long term, but. You know, and Democrats, I think, at least at the statewide level, there's just not a path for any Democrat to win in statewide because it's a liability. And you saw, for example,
is redistricting part of that, though?
Well, no, it's statewide. Redistricting is not. No, at the congressional level, it is certainly. Yeah. And we saw that even though you had a pretty good candidate in Darlene McDonald and a very progressive candidate, she got, you know, annihilated by Burgess Owens, and there was just no realistic path for her to win. And it's a big problem that Democrats are going to have to contend with for the next 10 years. And I think the voters are going to have to decide, well, okay, if there is an independent, do we throw behind that person or not? So I would like to see this experiment continued. I've advocated for it for a while because I don't think this Republican-Democrat dichotomy really represents where most Utahns are. And I think the partisanship kind of is almost cultish in some respects, and people are just too much of, you know, rah-rah my team, and they don't vote on the issues. And if you get an independent in the mix, you could potentially have that. Now, certainly it didn't play out that way this time with Leah McMullen because of all the money and all the attack ads, but I think that does at least foster some debate and discussion on those issues.
That Democratic convention this spring was one of the crazier things in politics I've ever seen. The coup, essentially, that happened.
The ouster of Cale Weston. Not the ouster, but the decision to back.
To not nominate him. Yeah. And there was certainly, it felt like a lot hard, bad blood left in the water still. And I wonder if in the future some of that bad blood will be gone, giving Democrats maybe a little bit more permission.
I mean,
foster this like independent idea.
Yeah, the Democratic delegates are a lot like the Republican delegates in that they are very strident in their partisan commitment, and they would rather. My perception of it, at least, is that they would rather fight and lose than give an inch. And they don't like moderates. They always disliked Jim Matheson. They always disliked Ben McAdams. And so when Ben came in and Jenny Wilson came in. And convinced them to not nominate Cale Weston, I think there is some bitterness. There is some resentment holding over. However, I think that Y2 Analytics did polling while voting was going on. It's sort of their equivalent of a modern exit poll, and found that 92% of Democrats ended up voting for Evan McMullen. 92% of them that voted, which is almost exactly what Misty Snow got when she ran 6 years ago. So where Evan fell down was he only got 17% of the Republicans. And again, that goes to sort of this partisan mentality where Mike Lee said, it's time to come home. We need this race. We can't, you know, we can't mess around with this because if we lose it, control of the Senate could, you know, hang in the balance. I think I didn't put this in the column, and I maybe should have. Another thing that really was a deterrent or a detraction, I think, for McMullen was none of the Utah Republicans got behind him. You know, even if he had gotten an endorsement from, you know, it didn't have to be Mitt Romney or it didn't have to be Gary Herbert, but a prominent Republican who maybe had a title by their name or maybe a Gail Miller kind of character. If anybody like that had gotten behind him, I think it really opens the door for Republican voters to say, well, okay, wait a sec, let's give this guy another look.
I don't want to harp on this for too long, and we have other races that I still want to get to, but the idea of you know, this pathway forward and the Democrats or sort of partisanship and strident partisanship on both sides, but, you know, the more that the party is abandoned, the weaker the party gets, right? Like, so if you, it's sort of a chicken and egg thing where the Democrats could be shooting themselves in the foot by not actually making the effort, because then the sort of party structure begins to fall apart.
I think there's an argument to be made that that's the case, but I also think that if you look at what we've gotten to a point where the parties matter less. They provide less and less service and less support to candidates. It's particularly on the Republican side. But in my mind, you know, Democrats have tried in the U.S. Senate path that they had taken in 1976, 1980, 1982, 1984, on and on and on. And it never worked, and in fact was they were doing worse and worse and worse as time went on. And so, you know, I think it was worth trying something different. And and you know, and the I also think that there's evidence that, you know, given that as you know, Suzanne Harrison did well, Sim Gill, Lanny Chapman in Salt Lake County, they did lose two House seats. Maybe that's because they didn't have a Democrat at the top of the ticket, but I doubt it. You know, so I think there's evidence that it didn't necessarily act as a deterrent or a distraction for Democrats down ticket.
Jeff, Robert points out that the state legislature got a little bit redder. The there were those two House seats that were lost. I think that there was that interesting story also. He mentioned Lanny Chapman of, you know, the county clerk's races. There was an effort by a number of candidates in or around the state who were election sort of conspiracy theorists, those who, you know, they wanted to get in those positions because they had a sense that, you know, elections were being stolen and so on and so forth. What happened with that kind of push?
So six total county clerk races in the state this year. The big one everyone's been talking about has been,
Utah County.
Well, in Utah County, as far as election conspiracies go, he did win, and that was actually the Republican nominee. And so that was probably more or less the site of the spring. Or this summer, excuse me, after the primaries. But there was a rebuke, I think, of other write-in candidates in other counties that had tried putting up an effort saying President Joe Biden wasn't elected. President. He wasn't fairly elected. There's been a lot of controversy, and there was apparently no stomach for those candidates in, like, Summit County or Washington County.
Well, and obviously not here in Salt Lake County.
Yeah, and so far, not here in Salt Lake County.
Yeah, I say obviously it's not
it's not called yet.
Yeah, and it's not a it's closer than I actually expected it that I thought it would be. Yeah.
And you know, Gal Marjani walked back his previous predilections.
He tried to
in the final waning hours of the election, but I also don't know how much of that's winking and nodding, and I don't know how much of that is, man, this isn't going to go well. Maybe I should try a different tactic. I certainly think Lanny's going to pull it off. She certainly has been the heir apparent, I think, this year.
Yeah, I'm calling it.
Okay. I'm calling it. Robert Kirky calls it right now.
Breaking news.
But is there what do you say about the fact that, for the most part, the sort of conspiracy theorists were left to the wayside by Utah Republicans?
Well, not just Republicans. Utahns in general, writ large, like the way we run elections. They trust the elections. And I mentioned the Y2 polling earlier. Somewhere, I don't have the number at my fingertips, but it's about 85% of the people that they surveyed said that they like the way that vote by mail works. They like the way we run our elections, and they trust the outcome. They trust that their votes counted accurately and that the elections are free and fair. And so when you have these fringe elements step into the mix, they're not going to get traction with voters who like the way we do it. And I think, to the state's credit, Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson, Spencer Cox, they were out very vocally and run, and there were ads, there was money put behind this to sort of say, hey, look, we do elections well here in Utah. We run them, you know, free and fair and accurately. And you know, yeah, there are going to be hiccups. In Iron County, they botched the mailing out of the ballots. But generally speaking, you know, and every year there's always somebody who kind of, you know, messes it up a little bit. But generally speaking, the outcome of the elections is trusted by voters. And so
is that different here than at the national? I mean, obviously, the conspiracy theories have taken root and have had a big influence around the country.
Well, and there are elements in Utah, the I'm just going to call them the whack jobs, who, you know, still buy into this. There is, you know, if 85% of them think they're free and fair, then there's a fringe that thinks they're not. But I think that we have a benefit here in Utah where we were doing vote by mail well before the pandemic. So when states that didn't have experience with it kind of started doing it, it's a little bit, when we started doing vote by mail, I was a little skeptical that it would go well, right? I thought there would be more problems. And you know, here we are several years later. I think we started it in 2014 as a pilot, if I remember right. here we are, you know, 8 years later, and it works great, and people really like it. So, you know, I think that's part of the reason that maybe election conspiracists haven't really taken over. As Jeff mentioned, the Utah County is sort of the exception because the Utah County clerk, not candidate, was chosen at the convention again, you know, and or did he have a primary?
Yeah, I was trying to remember if he was a primary.
I don't remember
or
if
not.
He had a primary yeah. or not, but and you know, it's kind of unfortunate because that candidate takes over for Amelia Powers, who was a very good clerk, who then went to be a commissioner, and Jeff Daniels Josh Daniels. God. Anyway, Josh Daniels did a really good job stepping in too. So you've had two competent clerks back to back down there, and now we have an election denier who we'll have to see how it goes. And I'm also curious about what he does with the marriage licenses. I think that's kind of an overlooked thing where he's vowed to get rid of online marriage licenses because he doesn't think gives it proper dignity, I guess.
Well, okay, I want to sort of zoom out again and talk. I mean, we could dive into whether or not Utah has any sort of role in the, you know, there was the whole predicted red wave at the national level that didn't come to fruition. Maybe we'll leave that to the side now and kind of zero in on a couple of things that I thought. I mean, I'll sort of pose the what was surprising to me question to myself. And my response is the San Juan County Council race. The fact that the San Juan County Council is now, as I understand it, Jeff, it's going to go back from being, you know, a Democrat majority and Navajo majority to being a Republican majority council. Is that correct? It appears to be right.
That's correct. Yeah. So with reporting from Brian Nathalie and Mark Eddington, the San Juan County Commission is going to go back to a Republican majority. After some reporting and some allegations that Democrats Willie Gray Eyes and Kenneth Maryboy were maybe or tangentially or suspiciously involved with some amount of corruption while they were acting as commissioners.
Yeah.
There's an ongoing investigation that kind of came out here in the last couple of weeks before the election. I have no idea.
Yeah, we talked about it on the show.
Yeah, I don't really have a pulse on like whether, like what you guys talked about last week, if Mathley's reporting had anything to do with that or not.
I mean, it was allegations made by an outgoing
attorney.
County attorney. But yeah, it's interesting. Robert Gergini, take on just the, I mean, this has been, it's been an interesting story because there was obviously the voter, the changing of districts by a federal judge. They had to redraw the districts, and that ended up benefiting, or so we thought, Democrats in San Juan County.
Yeah, I mean, I was a little surprised by the outcome of this one too, because they did have a Navajo presidential election that you would think would bring out Navajo voters on the nation. This has been a political football back and forth, the control of the council and you know, support or opposition to the Bears Ears National Monument. Hmm. And so, you know, I in the case of Kenneth Maryboy, it wasn't all that close. It was a little bit of a blowout. He had the more competitive, I guess, race when they ran before. But yeah, I mean, I think it kind of shows that San Juan County is this sort of political football that will go back and forth. That you saw Davina Smith do quite a bit better than either of these two candidates in her race against Phil Lyman. So you know, maybe there's something to be said there that it's not necessarily a partisan issue so much as it is a personality issue. I think maybe people are in San Juan County are tired of the drama, and at least the Republicans were motivated to make a change there.
Okay. We're running low on time here, but we should go to a break briefly. But, you know, maybe we can just quickly talk about something that was on everybody's ballot, the constitutional amendment. This was an amendment that was kind of confusing. The language itself was a little bit hard to grasp. And Jeff, the whole idea here was to give the legislature, to give itself more power in terms of how money was allocated when it called itself into special session. Can you explain that to us?
It would allow the legislature to allocate up to 5% of the budget as opposed to 1%, I think, right now, right, Robert?
That's right.
I honestly learned about it the same way that, like, because I edited Gerke's column about it, which was really good. And that certainly helped decide what my vote was going to be.
I take most of the credit for this, the defeat of this amendment.
So. Yeah, I think you should. I think we all voted Gerke.
That's good. Yeah, vote Gerke, everybody.
But it was interesting, though. Again, we talked about it, kind of the top of the hour. Like, I'm a new politics editor here, and, I'm kind of learning everything and seeing it for the first time. And the state legislature is so powerful here that I just kind of naively was like, man, I wonder if this will work, I wonder if it actually will pass, people seem to want to give the legislature as much power as they want, and this certainly was a rebuke of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think you had a dynamic where conservatives and Republicans saw that the legislature wanted to be able to spend more money, and they thought, nope, we're not going to go along with that. And then you think you had a situation where moderates and Democrats are like, they want more power. No, we're not going to give them more power. And you had probably some people in the middle, uneducated voters, who either left it blank or voted no on it as a default. But it failed, and it failed by a fairly significant margin. Almost, we're getting close to almost 2-1, I think. I think it was maybe for the first time that I can remember the public said no to the legislature. We'll see if it matters, because the legislature doesn't always care what the voters think.
Oh, you said the voters saying no to the legislature. The legislature has said no to the voters and by rejecting ballot amendments and so on and so forth.
5% was no small amount of money. I think it was $1 billion, right?
It would take it up from roughly $250 million to $1.25 billion. Plus, it also exempts all federal spending from it. So you could pass billions of dollars through the system.
Without a check from the governor either.
Yeah. Well, the governor could veto it at the end of the day, but in my mind, it's just if there is a legitimate emergency that necessitates being called into a special session and adjusting the budget by over $1 billion, possibly several billion dollars, then the governor should at least be involved in that discussion, and they should be at least somewhat on the same page, And we also saw them blatantly abuse this power that they had given themselves previously, calling themselves into special sessions to pass bills on things as vital and crucial as, improving train crossings. Mm-hmm. So, they abused the power that they had gave themselves before, and now I think voters maybe saw through it. I hope voters saw through it. Clearly they voted against it.
Yeah.
Utah's a state that prides itself on being pretty business focused and business friendly, and the idea that the state as a business could spend a ton of money without talking to the chief executive officer.
It didn't sit right.
Didn't really sit well, yeah.
I want to head to a break, but I do have one question that came in via email, actually, to me directly, and it's somebody who is going back to the Mike Lee, Evan McMullen, Kale Weston question, actually. He says, this is Craig, who writes, was it a good idea for Utah Dems not to nominate a Democrat but support someone who holds somewhat antithetical views to most Democrats? Should Ben McAdams and Jenny Wilson be held accountable by the Democrats for pushing this strategy? Robert Gerke's going to say, because he's in favor of the strategy.
I mean, I don't think Ben McAdams cares what the Democratic Party thinks of him anymore. Why should he? I think they did the strategically wise thing. I don't know that necessarily that Evan's views were antithetical to Democrats writ large, but Democrats make up 14% of the state, so that wasn't really the issue that they were most concerned about. So hold them accountable. I don't know how exactly they go about doing that. Jenny may run again for county mayor, and I guess she would have to go before delegates then and answer for that for what she did. But I guess the party can do what the party's going to do, and it's. And their record, I think, speaks for itself.
Well, and they also made the choice themselves. I mean, as a party in convention, to do what they did with obviously the push from these people.
If there was any effort to hold anybody accountable, it would be from a minority in the minority. So
it's third and long for Democrats. I mean, they've run the ball 3 times now. I think nobody wants a punt. I don't know. I don't tend to disagree with Gerke on this. Maybe it was a time to throw the ball.
Wow. And a football metaphor at that. Thanks,
terrific.
Jeff.
Yeah,
we are with that, there's actually so much more election coverage you can find at sltrip.com. Check it out. There's still some races to be called, but not very many. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We're going to take a quick break in the show and then come back with a conversation about the Great Salt Lake.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio. I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune State Watch editor Jeff Parrott, water and land use reporter Leah Larson, and news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our live Friday morning Utah News Wrap-Up, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling us at 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to at KCPW. Leah Larson from the Water and Land Use and Environment Desk. Before the break, we were deep in the realm of politics and government, election and its aftermath. I want to turn to a perennial but extremely important topic, the Great Salt Lake. A couple of pieces of reporting of yours here, Leah. The first one that I want to get to is that the lake has apparently entered a new kind of tragic phase. How so? What's going on there?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of efforts, obviously, to get water to the lake since it hit a record low 2 years in a row. But it doesn't seem like it's been enough and quickly enough, because the scientists that are regularly out there in the field checking on things are noticing strange things that they've never seen before. Most importantly, the brine flies that maybe if you visited the Great Salt Lake or Antelope Island, you saw these swarms of flies on the beaches are maybe kind of gross, but they're harmless to people, but they feed a lot of birds, more birds than even the brine shrimp. So those have gone missing. And the few that scientists have been able to find are small and acting kind of funky and don't seem to be thriving.
And the scientists say that this is a sign of basically the collapse of the ecosystem out there. I know you spoke with Bonnie Baxter from Westminster College's the Great Salt Lake Institute at Westminster College, who's a biologist. And I mean, what are the sort of consequences here? Obviously, not having the brine flies means you don't feed the birds. The birds go away. I mean, what happens here?
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, saline lakes across the world are shrinking and struggling and collapsing. So, years ago, maybe the birds would have gone to, like, say, Mono Lake or another lake in the West, if the food source wasn't available at the Great Salt Lake, but they're running out of places to go. So I think what we're probably realistically facing is a decline in bird populations, which could lead to endangered species listings. And we all know how much our state lawmakers love it when the federal government gets involved with things here. So that could very well be on the horizon for us.
Hmm. Microbialites. This is another sort of underpinning of the ecosystem, and actually one that the brine flies need to survive. These are these structures. They're kind of like rock-like coral structures, and they are they're also in really dire straits, right?
Yeah, so they're kind of the foundation of the food chain for the Great Salt Lake. Like you said, there's these little microorganisms that kind of pull minerals out of the water and mat them together, and then over time they form these like kind of bubbly looking rock structures. And because the lake is so low, a lot of them, I think most of them, have surfaced at this point, so they're drying out. And like you said, the flies, when they're like going from like being larva baby flies to adults, they'll like attach to these things while they go through those changes. And those are also food sources for the birds. Like ducks will dive down the water column and kind of gobble them up off of these rock structures. But with them being exposed, they have nothing to latch onto and be underwater. And then even the few that are still submerged are so close to the surface that wave actions are knocking them off. So that probably explains why we aren't seeing the swarms of flies like we usually do.
And this is sort of just like observational from the biologists who are out there, as opposed to, I mean, there's a lot of study that goes into looking at the brine shrimp. The Artemia, the eggs of the shrimp themselves are a big source of money out on the lake. It's a big industry, brine shrimping, used as protein for fish farms around the world. So that's studied very well. But the flies we kind of know less about. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Because like you said, there's not a viable industry that's funding research on the flies. And I don't know, maybe flies just aren't quite as charismatic as a shrimp or a bird or whatever. There's just far less known about them. So actually what Bonnie did with some funding from Audubon and the Friends of Great Salt Lake is she brought in one of the only people that's kind of done brine shrimp research in the West, mostly at Mona Lake. So he was out here late last month taking a look around and helping them build kind of a program so they can keep an eye on what's going on with the flies.
Mm-hmm. Well, water is the answer here. Obviously, we know that that's the solution, getting more water to the lake. One of the things, I mean, you have other people quoted in your story here on the what's happening in this sort of new tragic phase that the lake has entered, including Linda Freitas, who's executive director of the group Friends of Great Salt Lake. And she's concerned about some of the activity that's happening or the requests for activity that could happen to sort of dredge more, deeper channels to get access to more water. Can you talk about that and what is behind her concern about that?
Yeah, so U.S. Magnesium is having a hard time accessing brine, which it evaporates down to get minerals and process into magnesium. It applied to the Army Corps of Engineers to dredge the lake, extend its canals, get more water flowing in. And they also have to get a permit from the Division of Water Resources, I believe. I think lake advocates are a little frustrated with this because, we kind of all have made sacrifices to help the lake. A lot of us have ripped out our grass or let our lawns go brown. That's been the messaging from the state that we all need to do our part. But here's this industry that wants to take more water like directly right out of the lake. So I think that probably summarizes where she's coming from. Hmm.
Well, and then the other part of getting more water to the lake, there was a sort of announcement that came out from the governor's office maybe a week ago, a couple weeks ago, about sort of putting a pause on new water rights in the basin, in the Great Salt Lake Basin, as a way of ensuring, I guess, that more water wasn't taken from the lake. I know you wrote about this as well. How big of a difference might that make?
Yeah, so it was about a week ago that the governor issued this proclamation. It's basically just putting new water rights on pause. Any that have been applied for in the past and are pending would still move forward. But when I heard this, I was kind of like, who's applying for new water rights? We're pretty over-appropriated, and anyone who gets a water right would be so junior that in periods of drought, like we're experiencing now, like would they even get any water because they're so low on the priority list? So I went to the Division of Water Rights and just asked them like, hey, like how many like applications are you even seeing for water rights in the Great Salt Lake Basin? And it's actually quite a lot. I was surprised to get, more than 100 every year. And the state engineer, she told me that they have like close to 518,000 acre feet that have been applied for in the last 5 years, which is a lot. Wow. I was kind of surprised by it. But that number is sort of inflated by some like two permits in particular, and we can talk about those if you want.
Yeah. I was going to say that I know that the majority of these are actually pretty small, but then there are two giant appropriation requests. And yeah, what are those for?
So one of the big ones was for 400,000 acre feet. So the bulk of that 518 number that I gave you. So they wanted 400,000 acre feet. It was applied for by the state of Utah and the state of Idaho jointly to take out of the Bear River. And there was a lot of confusion when this application went out in 2018, and it's still confusing to this day, but it has nothing to do with the Bear River Development Project. Basically, Bear Lake, which is a natural lake that Utahns kind of turned into a reservoir about 100 years ago. So early season, they begin releasing water out of the lake in anticipation of spring runoff. So they can capture that and do flood control. But what these states want to do is maybe fund flood mitigation efforts downstream, like maybe buy some easements, and then that frees up that water that they can maybe send to municipalities and farmers when they need it instead of down to the Great Salt Lake. So still water that would go to the Great Salt Lake otherwise. So still concerning in that way, but there's like, it's pretty rare that they would actually, if this was approved, it's still pending, but if it were approved, would be pretty rare that they actually got 400,000 acre feet. It would have to be like a really, really wet year.
Right.
And then there was another one, if you remember the Utah Lake Restoration Project, where they wanted to dredge Utah Lake and make some islands.
Yeah.
Some of those project managers funders were claiming that they were going to, you know, create more lake water or free up more lake water by dredging, making the lake deeper and getting rid of invasive species. So some utilities and water districts preemptively applied to make sure they got access to that water if that actually happened, although it doesn't look like it's going to.
For either of these, I mean, obviously that latter one doesn't look like it's going to come, going to happen. But for, you know, I guess for the other one, they're pending, so they are not, they wouldn't be affected by the governor's proclamation, right?
Right. That's correct. So then, but I think it just goes to show you that, I mean, there are still efforts to get water that would otherwise go to the Great Salt Lake. So I know a lot of people feel like, well, this proclamation probably isn't doing much, but I just think it's interesting how these things are still going on, I guess. And I guess the other interesting thing to me about all the rest of the water rights that are getting approved is a lot of groundwater in rural areas. And we're starting to see that groundwater is probably over-appropriated too. So that's a little concerning.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And groundwater being basically aquifer water underground, right?
Wells, yeah. Yep. People digging wells.
Okay. I guess, Leah, I mean, it's just as a reporter who's covering this in depth all the time, the Great Salt Lake in particular, is, you know, this situation has gotten to a point where it's very, I mean, we talk about dust storms, you know, arsenic-laden dust, and we talk about the impact on the ecosystem. Are we at a point where it's like, it's too late, we're just so far past where we, you know, where we should be that that it feels insurmountable, or what's going on here?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll say when I went out to Owens Lake and Mono Lake earlier this year over the summer, I brought back some hopeful lessons from that. I mean, saline lakes like the Great Salt Lake are resilient. If we bring water to it, it can rebound. The flies can come back. The shrimp can come back. The birds can come back. But again, because they're all struggling across the world, and like these birds are running out of places to go, like I just feel like it would be better to take preemptive action than letting it get to that point, if that makes sense. Because again, we are facing endangered species listings and you can't just rebound from that in a year or two. So, but no, I mean, the Great Salt Lake is still worth saving. It still can be done. And, you know, just at least we're starting to see some political will.
Okay. Robert Gerke, news columnist. We're going to have to head to a second break in the show here in just a moment, but before we come back to our underplayed stories of the week, but the fate of the Great Salt Lake, it doesn't feel like it's really in all of our hands. It feels like it's in the hands of people who can get water to it quickly.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. What do you see here? It's tragic.
I just enjoyed hearing Leah describe this so clearly and learn so much about it. But I think that, you know, I keep going back to this. It took us 40 years to get to this point. We can't pretend that we're going to finally, in like a year and a half, taking these little moderate steps that we're taking, turn this around. It's going to take more, and it's going to take time. And maybe from what Leah's describing, we're running out of time. Maybe the collapse is already beginning, and it should send an alarm or sound an alarm for state leaders to do more and to, you know, and that means more sacrifice, and that's, you know, going to mean going to the agriculture community in the basin there and trying to get more concessions and more water to the lake, because the solution is not, it's not rocket science. It's getting more water from, you know, to the lake.
Well, yeah, I guess a last question on this is, you know, we know that there are efforts that have been begun to get more water to the lake in terms of a trust, you know, some money from a trust that was set up to basically pay farmers for the water so that it could come down. Are those, you know, are they just slowly happening, or are they not happening? Are farmers not taking the state up on that yet?
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like the gears to get this thing going have been moving pretty slowly compared to how quickly the lake is collapsing. I do think they have some creative solutions in the work that maybe will make a difference. But yeah, I mean, remains to be seen, right?
Okay. Leah Larson is water and land use reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. And thanks, Leah, for telling us about this. We really appreciate it. We're going to take another quick break in the show. And when we come back, I guess we'll turn to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. Stay with us.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jeff Parrott, Robert Gerke, and Leah Larson. This is our Friday morning Utah news wrap-up, and if you like, for the next few minutes, you can join us by calling 801-355-8255 with your questions or comments. We have a tiny bit more time, actually, before we turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And so, Jeff Parrott, I'm going to put you on the spot to tell us about the new state flag. We are getting a new state flag, right?
Well, one's getting proposed to the legislature anyway.
Yeah, it depends. There is a design adopted, and it goes to the legislature and could be approved. What does it look like?
That is some white mountains, I assume, representing snow on a background of red desert and blue sky, with it looks like a golden beehive and a white star with 8 equal points representing, I think, all of Utah stripes.
Okay, wow. Robert Gerke, is there anything to say about state flag? Do you like it, I guess?
This has been something that's been going on for a number of years. They've workshopped it and whatever. They didn't like the shield on a sheet that we had before.
Yeah.
I think it turned out as well as, I could have hoped. They're really excited about the marketing possibilities, and I'm not sure that, I am sure it's going to be more marketable than the last one. I've spent more time in the last 6 months thinking about the flag than I had for 49 years prior to that, and now I can go back to pretending it's not there and ignoring it.
Yeah. I thought a sort of weird, interesting sort of side note is that the old state flag is now going to become the governor's flag, was something that I read somewhere. I don't know if that's true.
There was a compromise that they didn't want to completely get rid of the old one. They think it has historic values, so it's something along those lines.
Okay. All right. Well, see the new design for the state flag over at sltrip.com. I think there's a story up about it.
Yep.
With that, we will turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week, where we highlight a story that you may have missed. And Leah Larson, I'll bring you in back into the conversation. Well, first I'll let you, do you have any comments on the state flag? Leah, I should ask you that.
I mean, yeah, that's all right. I really like Salt Lake City's flag better, but
yeah,
there's
okay.
My defense.
And that's also a new flag, by the way. But yeah, your pick for underplayed story of the week, Leah.
So mine, it ran over the weekend, and it was about the Bonneville salt flats. So the Great Salt Lake shrinking has gotten a lot of attention, but the salt flats are also shrinking, which has a lot of people alarmed. And this is actually a story by the Associated Press, but you can find it in the Tribune. And it was just really good and really interesting. And
cool.
They kind of threw some shade at people like me who like to go out there and take pictures in colorful dresses, but that's okay.
I love it. Okay, Leah Larson's pick for underplayed story about the salt flats out there. And thank you for that. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
I liked Leah's response to the flag. It's all right. My underplayed story of the week is it's ski season officially now. Brighton and Solitude opened yesterday, I believe. Everybody's going up skiing with their day off today, I think. And, so far it's been a good snow year. So maybe we're going to have our first good snow year for a while. And the lake issue will take care of itself.
Right. Yeah. Fingers crossed.
Julie Jagg has a story today at the Tribune about the opening of ski season.
Cool. Check out Julie's story at sltrip.com. Jeff Parrott, your pick for underplayed story.
Because we haven't talked about him enough on the show, Brian Maffley has a great story out this week about some mining interest out west for an element called indium, which I guess part of all of like the new tech elements that we're digging for now has to do with like touch screens and smart screens. And the possibility of mining it out west, which is worth a read.
Check that out as well. Indium. I mean, yeah, things you don't know about the what's inside of your smart devices and then where they might be found. And I know that there's also a push for mining lithium on the Great Salt Lake that has been covered. Leah has covered that, actually. Find that as well over at sltrib.com. I am going to go with, for my pick for underplayed story, it's hardly underplayed, but the Utah Jazz and their phenomenal season so far. 10-3, head of their division. Really remarkable start for a team without any noticeable. Well, I mean, they have stars, but they're playing more as a team than you expect in NBA basketball. Andy Larson has a lot of great coverage. Robert Gerke, any thoughts on the Utah Jazz for the next 30 seconds?
It's so much fun, and I think they have the best record in the league, if I'm not mistaken. It's remarkable what they've been able to do with sort of this ragtag group that you know, players. We lost the superstars, but these guys are playing every bit as good as them, and it's they're a lot of fun to watch too because it's team basketball. It's the games have been so much fun to watch. So
yeah, they're moving the ball around. Everybody's doing something, and you can count on just about anybody to score from anywhere.
And Jordan Clarkson and Mike Conley have really been providing a lot of leadership to the team, and I think it's an inspiring season. The whole tank note thing. I think they're costing themselves draft picks at this point, but you know, we'll stick around and ride this one out.
Right. Well, find all of the coverage we've been talking about today over at sltrib.com. That was Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune, Jeff Parrott, State Watch editor with the Tribune, and Leah Larson, who is water and land use reporter with the paper. Thanks to all of you for being here today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you, Roger.
Yeah. And happy Veterans Day. And listeners, with that, our show comes to a close. You can note that Behind the Headlines is a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Find podcasts over at kcpw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for tuning in. Join us again next week.